Switchboard. Why, hey, Sunshine. Let me transfer you. Please hold. Switchboard. Why, I'm just Peachy. Thanks for asking. Please hold. Switchboard. Oh, dang. He's just stepped out of his office. Can I transfer you? Please hold. Bill! It's your wife!
Times have changed. So should your PBX. Get Virto from Vox Orion, a hosted IP PBX for your business available from only 65 Rand per user per month. For more info, SMS your name to 45678.
And we'll call you.
Welcome to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by South Africa's technology news leader at techcentral.co.za. It's the 2nd of March. I'm Duncan McLeod. I'm here with Craig Wilson. Hi, Craig.
Hello, Duncan.
So it's been turned out to be quite an eventful week towards the end there, didn't it?
It has, yeah. It started off slowly, but then just mounted and mounted, and we have all sorts of fun things to talk about today.
Yeah, of course, the whole the deadline, or was it the deadline is the question, for the submission of by operators and other interested parties to the CASA process of licensing spectrum in the 800 and 2.6 gigahertz bands was the end of last month. And we're starting to see some interesting action happening on that front, the biggest so far of which is that we've uncovered that Convergence Partners, which is the technology investment vehicle owned by Andile Ntaba, the chairman of the executive
Dimension
chairman
Data.
Of Dimension Data Africa, is hoping to build a national wholesale LTE network.
Which is the biggest news we've had in months.
I think this is the biggest story of the year so far, without doubt. It's certainly an interesting development. Convergence Partners, of course, already owns has investments in a range of telecoms infrastructure projects.
Indeed, including the sort of fiber projects.
The FiberCo project, which is the national fiber network. I think they already, if I'm remembering correctly, they want to build a national network of 12,000 kilometers of fiber backhaul to connect all the major cities and towns in the country. FiberCo is obviously a project backed by Convergence Partners as well as Cell C and Internet Solutions, which is a division of Dimension Data.
Indeed, there's all sorts of overlaps here, yeah.
And Convergence Partners, of course, is also an investor in Intelsat New Dawn, the satellite
company
put up over Africa last year. And an investor in Seacom, the undersea cable system. So I think it's becoming quite clear here that that Andile is building quite a wholesale telecommunications infrastructure empire.
Indeed, and trying to cover all of the possible bases. And suddenly the name seems to ring a little bit truer. You know,
yeah.
What you really are seeing is a convergence across all of the possible means of connecting people.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I do wonder how long this has been in play. It seems to play directly into what TCAS is talking to in its draft documents around this process, where it speaks about wholesale open access wireless networks in the 800 and 2.6 gigahertz bands and reserving spectrum specifically for networks of that nature.
And it's nice to see this sort of preemptive move where you know, Convergence is positioning itself to be in line to be exactly what ICASA has been asking or suggesting.
Indeed, and of course, one wonders how many discussions took place before the documents were even issued by ICASA, but Andile Ntaba is certainly a very interesting character in this industry. He hates me saying it, but back in the day, he was the Director General of the Department of Communications. He left there and did a controversial deal through a consortium called the Elephant Consortium, where he bought a not insignificant chunk of Telkom from SBC, now AT&T and Telecom Malaysia, which were the foreign shareholders in Telkom. He later disposed, I believe he's fully disposed of that stake, but in the process he got shares in, if I'm not mistaken, in Vodacom and in a number of other entities, and he's used a lot of the investment there and obviously raised debt and brought in other shareholders into some of these ventures. But his plans to build a national wholesale network covering a range of technologies are suddenly starting to come into view. Mm. And I think that Andile is a bit of a kingmaker. He understands this industry intimately. And I think I think that Convergence Partners' plans here, in difference to some of the other projects that have been announced and from which nothing much has happened, I think this is quite an exciting development. The plan is to build, again, I spoke to Brandon Doyle, who's the chief executive of Convergence Partners, and he said to me, nothing is set in concrete yet because they still need to get much more detail in the final invitation to apply and get more detail through the whole public hearings process around this. But I think it's very exciting that they're talking actively about building a multi-billion rand national wholesale LTE network. The idea being that they provide access to this mobile broadband network countrywide on a wholesale basis, and that they don't play at all in the retail
market. No, they're not actually going to be selling the services themselves, just access to them for other players to then resell.
Resell to consumers. And they're talking about rolling this out into rural areas, making this available to new and emerging operators, smaller players in the rural areas.
It's definitely the most exciting news we've had in a very long time. Yeah.
No, it's very, very exciting indeed. So we'll be watching this very closely. I'm particularly interested in seeing how this plays out with some of Convergence partners, potential partners. They're talking about not doing this on their own, but working with other players in the industry.
Indeed.
And it makes sense to me, and I put the question to Brandon Doyle, is would it make sense for them to work with companies like Cell C and Internet Solutions, given the fact that they already work with them, co-shareholders with them in Fiberco.
Indeed.
And his answer to me was that those companies are natural alliance partners.
Mm.
We also heard from Alan Knott-Craig a couple of months ago when his appointment as the new Cell C CEO was announced. I had a conversation with him after that press conference, and he said that he was talking up broadband and how we need to get to a situation where there is more supply than demand in the industry, and that's going to upend the entire industry. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if Alan Knott-Craig has also been party to these discussions, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if Cell C was to become involved in this process somehow and make its infrastructure available. I'm not sure whether they'd be precluded from doing that. I suppose we still need to see more details around the invitation to apply and the rules around that, whether a retail player is going to be allowed to be a shareholder in a wholesale provider, whether it makes sense for Convergence partners to have a retail player in the space, because would that make other operators a bit more nervous about buying access on their network, all that sort of thing. So there's a lot of detail that's still got to come out of this process. But as you say, Craig, this is the biggest story in our sector, I think, in quite some time.
And these are all promising signs. And that comment from Knott-Craig about the sort of supply-demand, switching that around and having a sort of surplus of supply is really what we need to get to. And this is how we're going to connect the unconnected. So you've got people vying to undercut each other to get you cheaper services, as we see in some of the developed markets where the sort of margins are really slim and people really have to work to attract customers is really the dream for a lot of people, I think, as opposed to at the moment having to figure out what exactly it is you can afford and knowing that a lot of people are excluded on the basis that connectivity is still, relatively speaking, very expensive here.
Indeed. Of course, we've also starting to see the written submissions from some of the operators coming in.
None of them particularly favourable thus far.
No, I've been trawling through them in quite some detail. Both MTN and Cell C in particular have been quite critical of ICASA. On a range of levels. I'm not going to pretend I understand all of the issues that Cell C in particular has raised around issues of administrative justice.
Indeed.
But they are raising a lot of concerns. I think it can all be distilled down and summarized in one sort of point. What they're arguing is that they mustn't be precluded from getting access to spectrum simply because they already have access to cellular spectrum in other bands. They're making the point quite strongly, and I think correctly, that the players in the market that are best resourced, the best funded to build these networks, shouldn't be automatically excluded from the process.
Default.
Because it's not clear that there are going to be other operators coming into the space, and perhaps Convergence partners accepted. But it's not clear that there are going to be other players coming into the space that have the capital resources to build a national LTE network. There's no clear indication that any foreign investment, a BT or a Deutsche Telekom, would come in here and take advantage of it and really build a competitor network. So
this is the real problem. There's a real fear too that this spectrum be assigned only to sort of lie fallow, and that would be a terrible waste and further throw things back. Even when every time a date is moved, there are murmurs in the industry and sort of displeasure because it's not even about just getting the spectrum allocated and getting these networks rolled out and to sort of keep up with the rest of the world. But, the rest of the world is progressing all at the same time.
Mm.
The longer it takes, it's a case of it's not even catching up. By the time we've caught up to where they are now, we'd be further behind again, in a sense. It really does need to be fast-tracked. And the other thing I see coming out of these documents is talk about concerns about the vagueness of the sort of stipulations that ICASA has laid out. And I think people want some
much more detail,
sort of more concrete, far more substantial comments on exactly what is expected.
Yes.
And exactly what sort of obligations they're going to have to meet. So the other point that I thought was particularly interesting was the talk of, you know, existing spectrum holders not being obliged to meet the fairly sort of stringent requirements that ICASA is talking about for new players that get access to spectrum.
Yeah, MTN took particular exception to this. I hadn't actually spotted that in the original documents, but MTN is saying in its submission that some of the companies that are automatically going to be given spectrum and given additional spectrum, namely Wireless Business Solutions, which owns iBurst,
and
Centec, and there was a third, Neotel. MTN was suggesting that they're not going to be burdened with additional requirements in terms of rollout targets and that sort of thing. And they're also worried that the big chunk of the spectrum, 40% of the available spectrum, is going to be given to operators that haven't necessarily proved that they can make maximum use of that spectrum.
Indeed.
And that's certainly the case with Centec, which isn't using the spectrum at all.
No, indeed. And I think these are extremely legitimate concerns. Mm. I mean, whether they came from MTN or any other player, they certainly seem to make an awful lot of sense. And it seems bizarre that those existing players with access should be exempt from these sort of requirements. I mean, the requirements themselves, we talked to those briefly, if I understand correctly, those who get access to both ends, both the 800 megahertz and the 2.6 gigahertz range, are going to be expected to achieve something like 75% geographical coverage.
70%.
Mm-hmm. That was it. And if they only get access to the lower of the two bands, then that goes down to about 50%. But also, you know, geographical coverage.
That's 50%. The different figures, because I think the if you get access to 2.6 only, it's a target of, I think, 50%. I stand to correction here. Population coverage.
As opposed to geographical.
Yeah.
I think the 70% for access to both is geographical, and that's that's a really interesting stipulation
high.
As well, because also geographical coverage, as someone pointed out, I'm afraid I forget who, is a very peculiar one, because you know there are large areas of South Africa that aren't particularly inhabited.
It is curious,
and really, I think, you know, if we're talking about coverage, population coverage should be the figure by which we aim for. You know, it seems terribly wasteful to oblige companies to provide coverage in areas where there is really, really little to no demand for it.
I guess what ICASA is trying to do through that is to encourage rollout in rural areas.
Indeed.
I suppose with 70% population coverage, they could just do peri-urban areas, the urban centres, and probably just about get to that target.
Indeed.
But it most certainly is also ICASA's opening negotiating position.
Indeed, sort of start high and then sort of bargain a little bit softer as things go on.
But The other point which the incumbent operators raise, and the cynics would say they would raise it, but I think they have a fair, valid point as well, is you know, if they're going to license the spectrum to smaller operators, to emerging operators, do those companies actually have the resources to build 70% network coverage? And what is the impact? 70% geographic coverage, and if that requirement for 70% geographic coverage remains, what impact is that going to have on prices? Because that's obviously going to really push up the cost of a network build,
sure.
And the only way of recovering that surely is through higher prices, and is that not artificially going to keep prices high?
Doesn't this potentially then undermine some of the goals of the spectrum rollout in the first place, if the prices are kept high? And you know, even if we have coverage in rural areas, it's no use if those people in the areas can't actually afford it. We'll have to wait and see. It's certainly a complicated one, and it'll be nice to see some more clarity too coming out of ICASA about what exactly is required.
Extremely complex. I mean, going through these submissions, it's just the amount of complexity in this whole process is unbelievable.
And it's compounded by the you know, wide range of vested interests, and you know, there are a lot of people with competing interests, and it's going to be we all know this is going to take a very, very long time before we see it really resolved and real progress on the matter, but it's at least it's keeping everyone on their toes.
Mm. Good. I think we should move on, Craig, but just related to convergence partners before we move on entirely, you've been doing a bit of digging this week on the New Dawn satellite, which we spoke about a little bit earlier, and some of the problems it's been having. What's the latest there?
Yeah, well, the gist of it seems to be that half of it is operating as expected and the other half literally isn't. On launch, these things are sort of put into position and then automatically open, and they have this one has two large sort of reflective antenna that are one on each side of it, and the only one of these actually successfully deployed. And the problem is, I believe...
No, there was the Ku band one. The Ku band arm of it successfully deployed in the West antenna array, or whatever they call it.
Indeed, the one that relates to something that they call C-band, which I believe is good for sort of large-scale data transfer. between you know, the sort you do between between countries, or
okay.
you know, very the equivalent of sort of the fiber that we have running between continents. It's that right. It's C-band sort of designed for that kind of large scale, whereas the Ku band is used for things like broadcast, which of course we've seen talk of this week okay. from New Dawn as well, about how this particular satellite may okay. allow for more African broadcasters.
Just a disclaimer, neither of us are experts on satellite technology.
Yes,
so,
you may have picked that up.
So just from MultiChoice, if you're listening to the show, please excuse the
we apologize for the rudimentary explanation. But the fascinating thing too though is how this project was sort of financed. You know, it cost in the region of $250 million US, and you know, the problem is, you know, what happens if you launch it and it doesn't open at all? Then there's no money to be recouped. You can't get any customers if you can't provide the service. So they've literally had half of this. It's essentially half of the satellite isn't functional, and it seems that fortunately there is an enormous insurance policy, and rather a complicated one, in place, and so sure. the investors have been compensated for that half of the satellite that isn't functioning, and that process, I believe, has been wholly concluded. But the other half that is functioning promises to, for example, there's a lot of talk about making it possible for small broadcasters to pay for use of the satellite on a per channel basis. The idea being that you needn't necessarily have access to dozens of channels to be able to take advantage of it. And they're hoping to really sell off sort of use of it in small chunks. The other interesting point was that various attempts have been made to try and get the Western antenna to open as it should have, including maneuvering the satellite in different ways so that it picks up the sun, in the hopes that some of it might expand and other bits contract. And just fascinating to hear the different sort of techniques. You know, the problem is, once it's up there, there's not very much you can do. You can't just bring it in for a service. The other problem is that all of this, of course, expended some fuel in the process, but I'm told that it was deployed so efficiently at first that there was some sort of reserve, and that while I wasn't given an exact figure, the idea is that the useful life of one of these satellites is in the region of 15 years. And the suggestion, at least from Convergence, is that this hasn't been severely affected, not sufficiently enough that okay. it will really, really impact, you know, noticeably impact the life of the satellite, even if only half of it is functional.
Interesting. I would have loved to have read that insurance contract that they drew. It must be fascinating reading.
Indeed. Yeah. I suspect a weekend's worth.
Weekend's worth of reading.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, indeed. Good. Well, Craig, we're all running. The clock is ticking down quite rapidly, so let's move along. Mobile World Congress, of course, it was held in Barcelona this week. It's the biggest mobile show in the world.
Indeed.
And we obviously can't cover all the ground, but some of the highlights this week, I think we should run through them quickly. So the one that really stood out for me was, there were a couple that really stood out for me, but the one that I think grabbed many people's attention was the Nokia press conference, where they announced two things. Firstly, a cheaper Windows phone Lumia device called the 610, which costs €189. So they really are trying to push this Windows smartphone down into more into, I would imagine, this would be quite popular in emerging markets potentially.
Indeed.
And the second announcement, which I think really grabbed everyone's attention, was the announcement of a Symbian, I think it was Symbian powered, I think, 808 PureView cell phone, which has, wait for it, a 41 megapixel camera sensor. You're a bit of an expert on photography, Craig. Is this 41 megapixel sensor just nonsense, or is there, does Nokia got something here?
Well, I mean, you know, having looked at some of the sample shots that have emerged, now obviously these sample shots come courtesy of Nokia, and they're as good as you can possibly get, and beautiful lighting conditions, and
sure.
really, really everything optimized. But the important thing that makes the sensor valuable is that when you look at it, it's the actual size. You know, the sensor, aside from having crammed more megapixels onto it, you know, one of the problems with megapixels and what they call the megapixel myth is that, you know, for a long time, the standard the standard Nikon entry-level camera was the D40 for about sort of 5 years. And it was an absolutely legendary camera, and it only had a 6-megapixel sensor. But it could produce photos that you could print up to A3. The problem with some of these is that there's a false sense where they tell you, oh, you know, 16 megapixels, 18 megapixels, and really what they've done is subdivide existing pixels. And that doesn't actually result in higher quality images. It just results in a higher size files. This one, meanwhile, is actually at least a larger sensor. Now, it's not quite as big as the sort of APS-C or CMOS sensor you'd find in your average DSLR, obviously. But it's more in the range of the ones you'd find in a high-end compact. And that's really what makes the difference. You know, a bigger sensor is going to result in higher quality images, which is why you still have people in the advertising industry using medium format sort of digital backs that are, you know, 2, 3, 4 times the size of your average digital sensor. So the important thing with this 41 megapixel monster is that it literally has more surface area and the images are going to be better. I think what's fascinating is that, you know, what we're seeing cameras really, compact cameras at least, being gradually replaced by phones. I mean, in the same way that the iPhone 4S's 8 megapixel camera and the Samsung Galaxy S2's 8 megapixel cameras are getting so good that they really are rivaling compact cameras and making that sort of section of the camera market increasingly redundant. You know, what you're getting now is the divide between what you can carry in your pocket in the form of a phone and proper high-end sort of professional or serious amateur gear. And I think this will only continue that trend. You know, one of the problems that you can't get around, however, no matter how big your sensor is that if it's in a phone and you've got a flash on the back, and the flash is right next to the sensor, you're always going to get that sort of washed out look in images. The only way to counter this is they're getting the sensitivity, or what they call the ISO ratings, better. And I'd be interested to see how this sort of performs in low light. But nevertheless, it's also a great boon for Nokia, obviously. You know, people love to hear big figures like this. And hearing something like 41 megapixel in the same sentence as mobile phone is definitely going to have generated a lot of interest. Like you, I think actually the Lumia 610, this sort of low-cost Windows phone that I see some people are calling one of the cheapest Windows phone devices out there, I think that's actually the most interesting thing to come out of the Nokia camp. I think it's interesting to see how aggressively they're pushing Windows Phone. I mean, obviously, they've decided to put most of their eggs in sort of the Microsoft basket. I think that, you know, seeing the uptake of this, this is going to be the real driver for Nokia. They're certainly going to sell more Lumia 610s than they are PureView camera phones. It's great to see that they're so aggressive about this, but then I suppose they also have no choice. You were quite impressed with the time you spent with the high end of the Lumia range.
Yeah, the Lumia 800, I really liked it, but with one downfall, that the battery life was terrible.
Indeed.
I mean, really terrible. The more I used it, the more I realized that I actually couldn't use it because the battery life was so poor. In our interview with Stephen Elop a couple of weeks ago when he was here in Johannesburg, he specifically mentioned battery life as one of the feedback issues that consumers have provided to Nokia, and this is they're actively working on addressing the battery problem specifically in that Lumia 800 device. So hopefully they're going to be able to address it through software or through a better battery down the line.
Indeed, but this is also a challenge facing all of the manufacturers. There are very few that can provide anything resembling more than a day's use on a smartphone for a power user who has things like Wi-Fi on most of the day. I mean, we've played with the new iPhone and a couple of Samsung's devices, and almost none of them make it through a day. Invariably, we're at the moment, you're obliged to carry a charger in your car or on your home desk. And, you know, what we really need to see now is you could stop with the cameras and the processor speed and so on. What I'd really like to see is a battery that lasts 2 days.
Mm. Yeah. That's the one area of technology which doesn't seem to be improving particularly quickly.
No.
Right, some of the other, just running through them quickly, some of the other big announcements I thought that came out of the show was the Samsung Galaxy Note 10.1, which is basically the cell phone, or the phablet as they call it, that 5.3
that's
inch.
That's that horrible phrase, yeah.
Yes, that 5.3 inch cell phone.
Blown up to
tablet size.
Or really, if we look at it the other way, it's really just the Samsung 10.1 with a stylus.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
I think it's interesting.
It's quite interesting.
It's curious, you know, obviously there's that famous Jobs quote that if your device has a stylus, you failed. But I think Samsung are really trying to leverage this, and I think there is some potential to be had from it. I'm not sure whether I would use it that much. I have a stylus for my tablet. I don't find myself using it particularly often. It's an interesting move, though. I mean, what I love about Samsung is how many products they've brought to market, but not just to try and sort of fill it, but so many quality products. You know, we've seen so many good phones across the board, from those really entry-level sort of BlackBerry knockoff QWERTY keyboard type phones all the way up to their top-of-the-line smartphones. They're just producing some really, really quality devices. The build quality doesn't always feel quite up to sort of the Apple standards, but in terms of the innards, Samsung really have just gained ground. And, you know, that brings us to the next one, which is, of course, the HTC One X.
Yeah, I really like the look of that device. I'm due for an upgrade in June, and I'm currently using an HTC Sensation Android-based device, and the HTC One X, which is the, they've got a series of them, the HTC One X and the two other letters, I forget which they are, but the One X is the premium of their new smartphone devices, and it really looks good. And they said they're really pitching it on the music angle, and they're pitching it on the camera.
Indeed.
The fact that you can take a picture within microseconds.
And while shooting HD video.
And you can take multiple frame pictures.
In the region of 10 frames a second or something ridiculous.
It's a really nice looking device. So check that one out. Obviously running Ice Cream Sandwich from Google.
Indeed. It'll also be good to see, because HTC really have been quiet this year. We haven't seen, this year. It's only the beginning of the year. In the last sort of 6 months, yes. You know, while Samsung have been so aggressive, we've seen very few devices coming out of HTC's camp.
Yeah. Well, I must say the one thing that disappointed me about Mobile World Congress was there was no news on the Samsung Galaxy S3. I guess they're holding off in a couple of months on that one, but that promises to be a very exciting smartphone as well. But in terms of Android-based devices, I think the HTC One X is one of the most exciting Android phones in the market right now, at least until the Samsung Galaxy S3 is unveiled, which is rumored to be going to be only 7 millimeters thick.
Indeed, and this is the other thing that they've gotten so right, is the Samsung devices are always a little bit slimmer, always a little bit lighter.
Mm.
Yeah, it's going to be good to see what comes out later in the year.
But Craig, the biggest announcement coming out of Mobile World Congress this year has to have been Windows 8 Consumer Preview.
Absolutely.
Which I have installed on an Acer laptop I have here, and I am blown away. It's really, really, it's a really slick interface, massive improvement since the developer preview came out a couple of months ago.
Indeed.
And I think quite a few tweaks that Microsoft needs to make to it, just to make it a bit easier and perhaps make the transition from Windows 7 to Windows 8 a bit easier, because it is a really radical interface redesign. But I think Microsoft has made massive progress here, and I think I'm really looking forward now to the final product coming out probably by mid-year, sometime in the third quarter. The Metro interface is looking beautiful. I think once developers really start pumping out the Metro UI apps.
Well, and the more I've read about that, the more it seems like they're really trying to make it as simple as possible for people to develop for the platform. Obviously, as all of these OS manufacturers do, or developers do, they're really pushing hard to try and encourage developers to look at the platform and to figure out how to build content for it. But what's fascinating too is it's almost as though Microsoft has gotten a little bit of cool again.
You know,
it's just really, it's really slick and sexy sort of interface.
They've definitely turned the corner, and I think it's reflected in their share price, which has run up massively in the last couple of months.
Indeed, and what I can't wait to see too is how it actually behaves on a tablet, and how the sort of experience translates across devices, because it feels like Microsoft really is leveraging that as one of the best points of Windows 8 is the fact that you're going to have a similar experience regardless of what tool you're using to actually interface with it. And this is what could help them really regain market share.
Yeah, and fight back against Apple, which finally for this week's show has just gone through $500 billion market cap for the first time, 40 days after soaring to $400 billion market cap. The growth, the rise in that share price since they put out their first quarter results has been nothing short of astonishing.
And of course, with new products just around the corner, the new iPad next week,
Rumored, by the way, not to be called the iPad 3, but the iPad HD.
Indeed, but we don't deal in rumors here. We will wait and see, and we'll tell you all about it next week.
Absolutely. 7th of March is the big keynote happening in San Francisco.
But that suggests, you know, that this is the difference too. When we look at, you know, hardware, I mean, when we look at software companies that have been priced at these sort of, you know, hundreds of billions figures. The nice thing with Apple is Apple still makes tangibles. They make things that they sell. And that, to me, lends a little bit more credibility to these sorts of figures being thrown around, because there's real value to be had. You can measure it in terms of how many units they're moving. And it'll be interesting to see just how many of the iPad 3s they shift. We certainly know a few people who will be queuing in Santon at the iStore when they're available. I don't think we'll be amongst them, but we certainly know some people who will.
I'm not rushing out. I actually want to get a Windows 8 tablet when they come out later this year. Yes. I mean, just playing with that Metro user interface, I think it's, unless Apple comes up with something really significant with iOS 6, which may also, of course, be announced next week.
And which, of course, it may do.
But unless they come up with something really significant, I think Microsoft is ahead of the pack for the moment.
Indeed, indeed. And also, it's a little bit more exciting just in virtue of it being new.
Indeed.
You know, it's just
something
different.
Different.
Indeed. And there's appeal to that all of its own.
Yeah, for sure. Apple's no longer necessary. I mean, you're not
different if you're using Apple. Everyone's using Apple now, so
indeed,
it's almost maybe that's why Microsoft is kind of being seen as cool again.
Yes, there's that too, right?
You know, a universe that just uses Apple, certainly in the universe we operate in, the media universe. We just see Apple everywhere all day. So, the scary thing about Apple's share price and this $500 billion market cap is that based on looking at some of the metrics, specifically looking at trailing price earnings multiple, it's still cheap.
Right. Yes, it could go even higher.
It's on a trailing multiple of 15 times for a company that's growing its revenues by 50% plus on an annual basis, growing its profits by more than 50% on an annual basis. If it can keep that clip up for another year or two, who knows? Apple could be the world's first $1 trillion market cap company.
Indeed.
Anyway, Craig, we need to wrap it up there. As always, thanks for listening to the show. If you've got any feedback, you can email us at info@techcentral.co.za. From Craig and myself, Duncan McLeod, have a great weekend and a great week next week. Cheers.